Hello and welcome to AV Forums podcast for Monday the 9th of May. Is it a bank holiday today? No, it's not, unfortunately. Joining me on this edition are Assistant Editor Steve Withers.
Gentlemen, you had my curiosity, now you have my attention.
News Editor Mark Hodgkinson.
You silver-tongued devil, you.
Audio Reviewer Ed Selly.
D is silent.
And Mark Botwright.
Good morning, innkeeper.
Mark, you always pick the best quotes. I've missed you on the podcast, really have. Right, one-word answers to these questions, guys. Steve, has anyone famous died this week?
Not that I know of.
That's more than one word.
Oh, yeah. No.
Hodge, any competition winners?
No.
Ed, how many records have you bought whilst you've been drunk this week?
None. It's drunk. Too sober.
And Mark B, are you still excited about the Nintendo news?
Kind. Does kinda count as one word?
Yes. Just these days.
Yeah. Okay. We'll give you that one. Right. So welcome back to the podcast. Current competitions. We know winners, but this is what you can win. Ed.
Current competitions are Labyrinth on Blu-ray, open to all members, but it closes on the day this podcast goes out. So if you're listening to the podcast, pause it and enter the competition. We'll wait. You come back. Hustlers, Blu-ray, that's active members to the 20th of May, so don't bother pausing the podcast to enter that, you've got plenty of time. And there's a Pump Audio Headphones Mega Giveaway, all of those words are capitalised, so it's clearly mega, and that's open to all members until the 22nd of May. As we said, no one's won anything yet, previously, except the last guy, but more to come.
Excellent, good stuff. We've been looking at more UHD TVs. This time, Steve, you've been looking at the KS7500 from Samsung.
Yeah, it's their, I guess you could call it their entry-level SUHD model. That range goes from 9500 full-array backlight to the 9000 that we've already reviewed, the 8000, which is the flat version, and then this one, the 7500, there's also a 7000, which is the exactly the same, but is a flat screen version if curves are not to your tastes. On paper, at least, spec-wise, it's almost identical to the KS9000. So you're kind of thinking, why are they two basically the same TV? But there are differences, of course. They're not going to be identical. You do save yourself about £400 if you buy the KS7500 instead of the 9000, but you don't get quite as nice a design. It's, I'd say for Samsung, it's a bit boring looking. You know, quite often that they've been leading the way in terms of design, but this this TV, basically, it's just a curved panel with little chrome feet at each end. That's about it. Glossy black back, you know, rear and this kind of stuff. It's very, very simple looking. The 9000 is a lot flashier, a lot more interesting in terms of design. Picture quality wise, though, very good. It's a really solid TV. Obviously, no 3D. That's gone this year as far as Samsung are concerned. But in terms of high def and standard def, extremely good TV with a very accurate grayscale and color gamut, especially after calibration. Very accurate with Rec 709. Local dimming is good. Samsung local dimming is generally very good. I'd say not quite as good as on the 9000, but still good. Overall, it delivers a really good picture. When it comes to HDR content, again, it's very solid. Not as good as the 9000. I did feel that with this TV, more than with the 9000, the fact it's edge lit was limiting it a bit when it came to the peak brightness of HDR. There was more instances of bright edges and clouding with this TV with HDR content, depending on the content of itself. So like a bright lit scene outdoors, not so much an issue. But if you look at something like the end of Sicario or this beginning of Mad Max Fury Road, where they're inside dark tunnels and there's shafts of light coming down, this kind of stuff, that does give it some trouble, which wasn't the case so much with the KS9000. But otherwise, though, it does actually track the PQE OTF very well, which is good. 1,000 nits of peak brightness, 10-bit panel. The one area, and this applies to both of the Samsung TVs that I've tested to date, is they do not track Rec 2020 very well at all. In fact, as far as I can look at, they're really tracking DCI P3, which is wrong. They should be tracking within the native color gamut, they should be tracking to the saturation points for Rec 2020 because that's what's being used to encode the discs. We have told Samsung this. They are aware of that fact. I mean, I'm sure they know that. I mean, you know, the TV manufacturers, and they make an Ultra HD Blu-ray player, but as far as I can tell, they're not tracking correctly. And that is obvious sometimes, depending on the content, but certainly The Martian shows up quite well because although I've never actually been to Mars, I think the red planet shouldn't look quite so pink.
Oh, really? Hot surprise.
But having said that, you know, things I am familiar with, things like, you know, normal countryside and snow, for example, I think The Revenant looked absolutely stunning. So it's if you're tight for budget, it's definitely a good choice. If you've got a little bit more to spend, I'd probably be looking at the 9000 instead. So in this particular case, Samsung, their own worst enemy, because they're offering a number of viable alternatives to this TV without even considering other manufacturers. So it's all round, it's a solid 8 out of 10 recommended TV. Definitely very good. But the 9000 has the edge, which I guess makes sense. I mean, why would you have two TVs that are actually identical?
I don't know. Was that a question? Or
it was more of a rhetorical question.
All right, okay.
Do you think they're getting a bit hung up on the UHD Alliance specs, you know, because they're all quoting DCI-P3. Do you think that's what Samsung are following, mistakenly?
Possibly. I mean, certainly, if you look at the actual specs that the Ultra HD Alliance have created, they are, in some respects, there, as we mentioned in previous podcasts, they're reasonably, you know, difficult to attain. You know, you've got to get 1,000 nits of peak brightness. Obviously, what they don't say is for how long. We know it's on a 10% window, at least. But you're right, Mark. They do quote over 90% of DCI P3, which, whilst obviously that's what the content's been in, you know, mastered in terms of the cinema releases, and that's what they're using for the Ultra HD Blu-rays, that isn't how it's being encoded on the disc. So it would make more sense to use Ret 2020. But I guess one of the problems is saying 68% of Ret 2020 doesn't sound as good as saying 96% of DCI P3, even though it isn't a domestic format to start with, domestic color space. So, yeah, it's possibly that's the case. But, I mean, they must know this stuff. We know this stuff. Obviously, the Samsung engineers know this stuff. So it is curious. But I think they've got some problems there, because the way it's supposed to work is when you've got it in the auto color space mode, it's meant to detect the signal and then map accordingly. So if it's Rec 709, it does Rec 709. If it's Rec 2020, it does Rec 2020. What it's currently doing is Rec 709, regardless of what you send it in terms of signal. So that bit's not really working very well. So in turn, you have to select the native color space, and that's tracking to DCI P3. So maybe the problem is in the auto section, and it should be detecting Rec 2020 better and then tracking to that. So, I mean, hopefully it's something they can fix. It shouldn't be too difficult to fix that with a firmware update, really.
So Sony offer, you know, the choice of Rec 2020, don't they?
They do, yes. That's actually an option, and they track pretty closely to it, yeah, within the limitations of the panel's native color gamut. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that I think we've already discussed having, I think your first TV was a 350-nit HDR television, and you were quite impressed, but then you finally got your hands on I think, was it the XD93 with 1,000 nits, and suddenly you realise that not all HDR TVs are equal. No. I'm getting the impression now that not even within the Ultra HD Alliance specs are all TVs necessarily equal either. So it'll be interesting to see what happens going forward. But there's no question that Samsung certainly are trying to deliver as many TVs as possible that meet the minimum requirements for Ultra HD Premium certification.
Okay, so that's a review there. And of course, it's up on the website, it's on the homepage. Go and have a read at it. There's some nice looking graphs there as well, and proper graphs as well. We use the right ones for tracking HDR stuff, and we have done right from the start, haven't we, Steve?
Yes, we have indeed.
Right, let's move on and stay with Samsung, because they've now turned around, Mark, and said, after 3 years of looking at it, they're still not convinced OLED TV is the future for the foreseeable future.
Yes. I mean, if it's not 3 years, even though they said that, this was after CES 2014 when they came out and said, look, that's it, we're hanging fire with OLED. We'll wait and see how it goes. We'll wait and see if we can get the manufacturing costs down and, you know, make a viable consumer product. And they've actually given it just over 2 years, and they've decided that it's not part of their future direction. There'll be definitely no OLED in 2017 from Samsung, and you've got to assume you won't be seeing one for 2018 either. They must have at least a 2 or 3 year roadmap, you would think. And they're bigging up Quantum Dot, which is a slightly strange comparison, I guess, over OLED, and they say, you know, it's they're saying that Quantum Dot can progress faster than OLED from what they are seeing.
Well, it's cheaper to use, and they don't have to pour billions into the R&D side.
Well, that is definitely true. Yeah. I think he's specifically referring to the ability to deliver a wider colour space.
Yeah, they're going to start heading towards as much about 2020 as they can get, aren't they? That's going to be their gambit.
Yeah, there's a 27-inch monitor, which I found out when I was doing this yesterday. There's a 27-inch monitor now that it's 95%. Of Rec 2020, so yeah, using Quantum Dot, obviously. So I guess if they can start hitting much wider colour spaces next year and the year after, that's something to tout over OLED, which is not looking likely to hit anything like 90% of Rec 2020 in the immediate future. But of course, that's ignoring the fact that OLED can go much blacker and deliver much greater contrast than LED, regardless of quantum dot.
Of course, and we've covered this before, black levels on an OLED are in no way comparable to the LED switching off on a LED LCD TV. There's no comparison.
No, and that's part of the reason why the UHDA has got two specs, hasn't it? It's got the OLED spec and it's got the LED spec. So,
yeah. And I think, you know, personally, I would always go with the self-emitting technology. I mean, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, but it is the truth. You know, LED LCD TV, it's always been flawed. It always will be flawed. And every incremental improvement is to make it more and more like a self-emitting panel and trying to get down to the pixel level, whereas OLED does that straight away. So the only weakness in OLED really is the brightness factor. But again, Steve, it's not really that big an issue when your starting point is so much lower than an LED LCD.
Yeah, it goes back to the comments we made about dynamic range, isn't it? I mean, it's, if you're starting from absolute black, even if you can't go up to a 4,000 nits, if you can hitting, you know, 500 plus, that dynamic range is still really big and has real impact. Whereas if you're starting at 0.05 instead of not 0.001, you know, you've got to go brighter to retain that dynamic range. So, I've certainly seen some demonstrations on OLEDs where the, the specular highlights have really impacted. Even though I know they aren't technically as bright as the LCD TVs, they still have impact and still look really good. So, yeah, I reckon what we'll see Samsung do is go for 4,000 nit panels. I reckon that'll be their goal, 4,000 nits and as wide a colour space as they possibly can squeeze out of a quantum dot telly. And that'll be their gambit for next year. You know, never mind OLED, you know, we can do TVs that can really hit the specs. I think that'll be their goal, because basically, I guess they're struggling to find a way of making OLED TVs, and they're never ever going to go and buy them off of LG. So they had to find a way of making their own panels at a cost-effective, with a cost-effective method. And I guess they're struggling.
Their marketing arm could make this quantum dot versus OLED, couldn't they? Regardless of the truth and what sounds slightly cooler to the public, quantum dot to me just sounds really cool.
Well, just go back to LED TV.
Yeah.
You know, no such thing as an LED TV.
Yeah. Well, that's why, Mark, isn't it? They started cool. Remember last year it was nano crystal? Didn't sound very cool. Quantum dot, a lot cooler. So they've gone back to quantum dot this year because they're in a mission. They said, yeah, people recognize the name and like the name more than nano crystal.
I don't know. I quite like nano crystal. Makes it sound like something in a lightsaber.
Nano and quantum are both bullshit bingo words of the period. I mean, quantum is a dodgy one for this industry because flirting on the right side of litigation, a number of cable manufacturers have been abusing the word quantum to within an inch of its life for the last 10 years. So I'm innately suspicious.
They've actually built a quantum cable where you may or may not get the signal depending on whether the cable's being
a bit like your internet,
like Schrodinger's cat.
A bit like your Skype conversations, to be honest.
Yeah, my internet connection's shit at the moment.
Quantum Steve.
Yeah, I don't disagree with any of these sentiments. I mean, essentially, it does strike me that it's not that. It's not necessarily that Samsung haven't seen the potential in OLED. They haven't seen the potential, or they haven't seen the fiscal sort of pragmatism of them doing OLED. So we'll see how that goes. Well,
they went down a different route to how LG have done it, and it obviously didn't pay off. And I think it'd be a cold day in hell before they copy LG.
Wrong to say didn't pay off. I mean, I guess, as it stands, as I understand it, both companies are in the black. They're both in themselves viable models. But yes, they clearly have, in terms of competitively offering OLED, and as you say, the slight hang up of ordering bits off their arch rival. They're in a different position. I guess it lives or dies on whether they end up being the only people still pushing LCD based televisions, and after everyone else has switched to OLED. So we'll see what happens after that if everyone switches to OLED.
Like Phil says, the quantum dots are fairly cheap, off the shelf almost solution now. So you think that most of the manufacturers will go down that route and have the odd OLED like we're seeing now.
Quick question, though. With regards to OLED, if it's not going as bright, how do these things demo in store, in kind of bright, you know, electronic stores, when compared to, you know, something that will go a significantly, you know, greater degree brighter. The plasma always looked muted and just didn't seem to demo very well. You know, you went into this kind of giant hangar style, you know, electronics retail giant, and it just looked poorer.
It's not as bad.
Not as bad.
It's not as bad as plasma, but there is a difference there when you're talking about brightness, definitely. But for me, certainly when you see an OLED set up properly next to an LED LCD TV, there is no contest. Absolutely no contest.
No, got to agree with that.
Wish LG would get their artisan gear and get some samples out, eh?
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Yes, I've had a couple of different organisations bemoaning slightly large holes in their schedules for various publications, which should be filled with LG OLEDs.
The bizarre thing is, they're in the shops, so, you know.
Okay, so, I mean, that's obviously Samsung saying that. I mean, they will say that because they have no alternative at the minute. But LG, they have been known to drop the ball and have been dropping the ball in the recent past, Steve.
They have had issues in the past. And they have been somewhat guilty of over-promising and under-delivering quite often, particularly when it comes to timescales. But I definitely think they are moving in the right direction. I mean, it's an incredibly complicated technology that they have largely developed almost on their own and invested billions of dollars into and taken a hell of a gamble on. And it does take time for these things to reach a maturity. And I think we're beginning to get to the point now where that technology is reaching a maturity. Certainly, I mean, we haven't, fortunately, haven't tested them yet, but what I have seen are demonstrations of the E6 and the G6, particularly, also seen the C6, have not seen the B6 at all yet, is that they looked very impressive. They have been addressing issues like the dark edges, the vignetting that has been picked up in previous generations, and also the gradation just above black as well. They've been working on that. So they are listening to feedback and they are trying to improve the technology. And I think they've taken great, great leaps and bounds. And if you look at what they're delivering this year in terms of peak brightness, in terms of format support, in terms of color space, you know, they're really moving in the right direction. They just need to, you know, I think obviously they are still quite expensive. I mean, they're targeting them as a premium product, but if they want to get mass acceptance, they need to get the prices down a bit. And certainly this generation appeared to be even more expensive than last year.
But Steve, when you look at the UK TV market, most sales are in the £2,000 and above bracket. That's where the biggest...
That's true.
The biggest growth is in that area.
There's been a big shift to, certainly a big shift to larger screen sizes, and also a shift towards more premium product, unlike the US, it has to be said. And LG will say that when you look at that price bracket, they actually have dominated in terms of sales. And that's almost entirely through OLED. So I think it's beginning to pay off for them, actually. It's been a gamble, no question about that. But it looks like it's beginning to pay off. And I think ultimately, regardless of what Samsung say, and let's be honest, I'm going to quote Manu Rice-Davies here, they would say that, wouldn't they? I think regardless of what they say, the future is OLED. That's definitely the future of television technology. And there's no question in my book, having seen it, and as you just heard said earlier, Phil, you know, when you compare the two, there's nothing in it, you know. OLED looks stunning. I saw an OLED TV just last week and I remember thinking, God, that looks good. And that was like an EG960 from last year. It still looked bloody brilliant. So, you know, OLED's the future. We just need more manufacturers now to get on board in terms of OLED. And hopefully we'll see a lot more of that action come IFA. If I was to buy a TV this year, I reckon I would I'd almost certainly be getting an OLED.
But you're not going to buy a TV this year, are you?
Depends, really. I'm quite tempted, actually. But it's all about budget.
Yes, I don't have any of those.
Exactly.
So that's OLED. And then talking about Ultra HD Premium, UHD Alliance have bestowed such an award on the K8500 Ultra HD Blu-ray player from Samsung this week, Mark.
They have, yes. We knew this was coming, didn't we?
Do you think it'll be sitting pride of place next to its AV Forums award?
I would think the AV Forums award takes precedent, to be quite honest with you. But yeah, following the software update, which happened like almost immediately after it was released.
Has there been a software update?
I got one. Mine updated on the first day. So it's been an update from its factory setting.
Oh, you mean from the first day it was actually released?
Yeah. So
it's yesterday.
There was an over-the-air update I got when I first plugged it in. So that's as much as I know. And it's stuck on that ever since. And it's been out a good few weeks now, hasn't it? But anyway, the Samsung have confirmed that the UHD Alliance have certified this TV to pass all its various testing protocols which we don't know anything about whatsoever. Unlike the TVs, where we've got, you know, a good set of criteria, 10 or so bullet points that we know the TVs have to hit. Basically, all this has to do is be able to read all the information off the disc, which is you know, reassuring that you're not going to miss half the movie because it can't be bothered reading some of it.
I think we should set up the UHD Rebel Alliance and set up our own certification points, and then we know what the hell's going on.
Yeah, so as far as I can aware, all the impact it will have on people's lives is that future models shipping will have an extra sticker on the box.
Yeah. Wow.
Looking at the Ultra HD Alliance's specifications for distribution, which I'm guessing is what this comes under, every single Ultra HD Blu-ray player would meet those criteria.
It would be unsaleable, you would think. So
Yes.
So well done, Samsung.
And Panasonic, since they both got it.
Panasonic, for sure. Oh yeah, that left with it out of the gates.
Is this like a modern version of Sports Day? All must have prizes. All must be certified.
It does feel like that, actually. Yeah.
Well, they do need things to, you know, stick on the box and have on the websites, don't they? Shiny things.
It would seem little point in putting together this alliance and then creating a certification program if you're not going to use it, Sony. Because it's obviously something that people actually the little logo is really growing on me, actually, as well. I kind of like it.
Which logo?
The little UHD premium logo. Because you see it on Ultra HD Blu-rays and everything as well. It's kind of like it.
I'm going to demand a sticker for mine.
It's just because it's got the word premium, Steve.
Yeah, it means nothing, but it looks cool.
I mean, if Waitrose started selling UHD Blu-rays, you'd be there in a flash, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Probably. May have been got a bit mad recently on purchases, actually.
You're always so balanced in terms of your adoption of stuff.
I'm up to four now.
Wow.
25.
Ridiculous. You had 15 this time last week, you maniac.
I know. Well, WoW HD got a particularly large order off me last week.
Christ, I must love you.
Yeah, well, I mean, we all spend our money on different things, don't we? And we all enjoy different things. So, yeah. I don't think Ed can see anything. Can you, Ed? Because you'd go and spend exactly the same amount of money on bits of vinyl.
Yeah, except that my media purchases will probably be worth more in a year's time, whereas Steve's will be landfill. But, all right, I'll be a charitable, not a year, 5 years.
Yeah, I'd rather put mine into a car. Mark, what do you spend your disposable on?
Say drugs.
Unsurprisingly, video games and consoles.
And I like how you put consoles in. I take it you're going back retro now and you're buying old consoles now, are you?
Yes. Yeah. I am looking. I think I've got about six plugged in at the moment.
Do you want an original PS3, big chunky one that does SACD and all that?
Have you
kind
got
of thing?
One of those?
I have, yes. It's a Region 1 as well, Blu-ray player.
Does it actually work?
It's never been plugged in for about 4 years, but I could go and try it for you.
I
would potentially voice an interest in that. Ironically, not to do anything with games on it.
But send it off to Ed, because I'm running out of plugs here.
If I've got two, it's competition, so, you know, bid away.
You can mod it, can't you, to strip DSD, can't you?
Yeah, they can become DSD rippers, those first-gen ones, and that doesn't have any bearing at all on the region of it. It makes no difference at all.
That depends if the drive's still working.
That really does depend.
Because the problem is, I had two of them that died.
Well, I can tell you this, right? It was never used for video games.
It was used as a Blu-ray player, wasn't it?
Yeah, and even then it wasn't used up because I replaced it quite quickly with a standalone. So it's hardly been used, and it's probably been switched off after about 6 months use and never switched on again.
Does it need a power adapter?
Switch
mode.
It's switch mode, so it'll run off UK power straight into it. You don't need a
this very public podcast in front of our listeners is not the time to discuss this, but I will discuss this with you further, genuinely.
Good. That goes towards the holiday fund.
Turn it into a competition prize.
No.
And make Ed have to enter.
No. I'd rather have Chris £20 notes in my back pocket. Thank you very much.
Asking what enter the competition. What's the question prize? Is your name
Give
Ed
us £10.
Yes, no.
Yeah, but it's £300 to enter the competition. So there you go. Right, moving on.
Well, I need to tell you right now I'm not paying you £200 for it. Before it goes any further.
Yeah, I'll have to go and have a look on eBay and see what they're going for. Right, anyway, moving on. Mark wasn't very happy this week because his kids' programs look like they're going to get moved by Sky. Explain it a bit more.
Oh yeah, I got generally annoyed. I think I've had backache all week. It's probably contributory. I'm not feeling quite so aggrieved about it today. But anyway, Sky announced a new pass for their streaming service, Now TV. I'm currently paying $6.99 a month, which is the entertainment package, which gets you, well, Game of Thrones for me, but plus plenty of other stuff off Sky Atlantic and quite a lot of channels actually. And that has also included live streaming and box sets from Nickelodeon, Nick Jr. and the Disney Channel, which has been really handy for me because I can stick the kids in another room when they want to watch their American crap. Which they do. They love this stuff on there, particularly Nickelodeon and Disney Channel. That, you know, it's priceless to them. They absolutely love this stuff. But they're now siphoning that off as from the 21st of June and creating this new Kids Pass for an extra $2.99 a month. And you do get a little bit of extra. You get stuff from Boomerang and Cartoon E2 and CBeebies and CBBC and Milkshake, most of which you can get for free elsewhere, I might add. They're creating a new user interface and some parental controls. And that's about it. So they're basically taking away more than they're giving, in my opinion, because the premium stuff is the Nick and the Disney Channel stuff in terms of what kids want to watch. Blockbuster shows that get a lot of marketing, a lot of exposure, they're all on those channels. And then charge you another £3 of privilege to keep it going. So what I'm thinking I'm going to do is I'm going to cancel my entertainment pass. Sodom, I'll wait for Game of Thrones on Blu-ray and then...
You can't do that.
Ah.
I would have cancelled it after
I would have done yesterday. If I'd have got around to it yesterday, I would have done it. I would have seriously done it. But it's not going to happen until the 21st of June anyway, by which time...
By then you'll have forgotten about it, Mark, and you'll just...
Oh, yeah, that'll be a long-forgotten memory. I'm on a temporary sort of rant, which will probably pass, but and I'll no doubt completely forget and I'll just end up subscribing to more and paying them another £3 a month like the mug I am.
Yeah, because they're not going to reduce the entertainment pass, are they?
No, well, they have added National Geo Wild.
You know, so they're entirely splitting off then all the kids' stuff from...
Yeah, there'll be no kids' stuff on the entertainment pass whatsoever. It'll all go. At present, there is only Nickelodeon, Nick Jr. and Disney content.
A little bit short-sighted, though. Because I'd imagine there are a lot of people who will get those entertainment passes and kind of almost write it off as, yeah, it's something for the kids as well.
And yeah, that's exactly right. So it started off at $4.99 a month, which was excellent value, and it's gone up £2. And effectively for me, it's going up another £3 if I want to keep what I've got already, which is, you know, so it's more than doubled in price in 2 years or so. It's not huge sums of money, but it all adds up.
When I got rid of my Sky, I also got rid of the Now TV. I got Now TV, but then I looked at the BT package and it was better value, so I ended up buying that. You get more of the Discovery and Nat Geo and the Crime and Investigation and all that kind of. You get more of those channels. And H2 is a brilliant channel for just the amount of absolute head cases and heed the balls that are on that channel.
H2. You know,
History 2. So it's all about ancient aliens, like ancient civilizations.
The History Channel is now named for irony purposes.
Yeah.
Don't read your Eric von Daniken. It's history.
Yeah. It's just porn stars and that bloke who looks like he's been probed.
Storage Hunters and what's the other one? American Restoration, whatever that's got to do with history. And feeling that, it'll be something about the Nazis.
I was going to say, you can make so many documentaries about World War II, can't you, really?
So, swiftly moving things on from history channels that aren't history, B&W have been bought over by a tiny startup company. Tell us all about it, Ed.
Well, I'm still a bit loose on all of the details on this, but yes, seemingly without any significant precursor, one of our more venerable loudspeaker companies has been snapped up by a company that anyone outside of the sort of tech bubble had little or no prior understanding of. The company is called EVA or EVA Automation. Apparently it boasts 40 employees and it hasn't yet done anything. which makes it, I mean, actually it makes it a perfect modern company. That appears to be the template for success these days. But they have bought Bowers & Wilkins. They haven't released much in the way of details of what they paid for it. I mean, if they've done anything like crazy, like the Manchester United deal where it's been financed on, they've bought the company using, you know, you can buy companies using companies' own assets, which always strikes me as a peculiar undertaking. And we don't know what they intend to do with it.
They're going to come up with some new lifestyle products, that's for sure, because that's the biggest hint of them all. And the guy who's going to be the chief executive, I can't remember his name off the top of my head. Mark, you did the story, maybe you do.
Three lines, it's Gideon Yu.
Gideon Yu has said that he's going to create an AV product that doesn't exist anymore, but he wants in his living room and everybody else will want in their living room, which kind of suggests that they're going to go lifestyle product. But what he has said is... keep dreaming, Steve, keep dreaming. What he has said is it won't affect the current business and current products and that kind of thing. They will stay, the staff are all going to stay. The chief executive of B&W is now the CEO of this all-encompassing company now. So he stays on as a board member and has a very big shareholding in that as well. So I don't think there's going to be mega changes. But certainly lifestyle product, reading between the lines, that's what they're coming up with. Some kind of...
Well, to be fair, I mean, Bowers & Wilkins have been doing that with some degree of success already. That would make them a logical candidate, because it's not like they're doing it out of the blue. They've been producing products which have a degree of mainstream appeal. So yeah, it could be good.
I think it's very much along the Sonos line. I think that's where they're going to head. Sonos, sort of music cast type thing.
Yeah, they're a smart home type company, aren't
they? Yeah. So that's the way they're going to go with it, I think.
I mean, a number of companies have done quite well when they've been bought by unusual organisations and sort of treated as hobbies. I mean, one of my favourite brands, a Norwegian company called Elektrokompaniet, bought by a company that makes missiles. And that's actually meant their product is an awful lot better assembled, and they're making some very interesting things. The name Focal Group, they have venture capitalist investors, which they seem to have, there appears to be no definite steers in terms of what they've been doing. They just appear to have the wherewithal to sort of crack on and develop what they want. So we shouldn't be too uneasy. Well, I mean, it's all a bit surprising, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. I'll be interested to see where it goes from here.
I'm just interested in this company that makes missiles.
Well, it's called West Control. They're mainly involved in anti-shipping and things like that. But by the same token, I mean, it's actually, you know, it's not bad. I mean, if you buy a missile, A, they're extremely expensive, and B, you do tend to want them to work if you have to use them.
But so, they are also only one-time use items.
This is true, but there is no margin for error. So, you know, see where it goes.
Disposable society.
Yeah,
but you say that, but they are only one time. But given how infrequently they're used, munitions actually end up being around for quite a long time.
They have to last years.
So, you know, it's all still at still a level of build quality required. So, yeah, it works out quite well.
Okay, let's move things on and talking about tiny startups. I know why Steve's picked this, because he's obviously misread it. The Rock Clock.
I'm going to blame Ed for this, by the way, because he's the one that sent me the link yesterday when
it
was actually
released.
Yes, this
is all my fault.
Completely his fault. But yes, Dwayne The Rock Johnson has released a motivational alarm clock called, and I'm going to say this carefully, The Rock Clock. And I downloaded it onto my phone yesterday, and it's great. Basically, you can set motivational goals. So I set mine to eat more greens. That seemed like something I could achieve. And then you can set the alarm as in to wake you up, but it's at any time, obviously. And when it does wake you up, it wakes you up to The Rock singing to you, which is quite cool. But you can also set the alarm to rock time. So when his alarm goes off, your alarm goes off. Now, apparently, The Rock's a very early riser. He gets up at 4 a.m., but he lives in L.A., so that's 12 lunchtime here, which I think I can probably handle. So, yeah, set my clock to rock time. Get woken up by The Rock singing Good Morning Sunshine, and job done, really.
The Rock's clock.
I am pleased to say it is free. You're not being invited to hand over money for this.
It's totally free, and there's also no adverts on it either. Which I commend The Rock for.
I also noticed there's no snooze button.
No, you got to get
the
up.
The Rock doesn't believe in snooze buttons.
The Rock doesn't stop singing till you get up. Yeah, it doesn't. It actually says that on there. The Rock does not believe in snooze buttons. Good job, buddy. Come on, get up, get up.
I'm trying to think which other celebrities could give us sort of apps along these.
I'd like a kind of art program, Vin Diesel's easel.
Christian Bale's anger management app was quite something.
Have you beaten up your mum today? No. Good.
Safe driving with George Michael.
The sat nav that just shouts "Wake up!"
You know there is a sat nav that's voiced by Brian Blessed, isn't there?
I can see that getting old really fast. But yeah,
what was the bad of the sat nav also said things like "Gordon's alive" every now and then.
Again, come on, that would be hilarious for 4 minutes, and then it would just be a massive pain in the arse.
I did it as a joke on my parents on their Tom Tom, and I put Ozzy Osbourne as the voice on it, not realising that he actually swears in car seats.
He also slurs a lot, so you can't understand a word he's bloody saying anyway.
It was funny for the first time, but after a while, they stood over me while I changed it.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again. If Emily Blunt ever records a full set of Tom Tom voiceovers, that's straight where I'm going. She's just got the best voice going, full stop.
Okay.
Just be perfect. I drive everywhere with the sat nav on.
And Steve just wants to get up with a rock.
Well, get up you will. You've got a lot of choice. I should imagine with the Rock, if you don't get up, he'll actually come round to your house and physically make you get out of bed.
I suppose at your age, you no longer wake up with a rock, do you?
Oh, boom tish.
But what does he say if you fail?
I don't know. I've
chastisement from the Rock might crush you.
The phone just explodes.
Self-destruct. So he's given this away for free, but actually he's a criminal mastermind and he's now got everybody's bank details and all your logins for all your apps.
Yeah, it's basically the same plot as Kingsman, isn't it?
To be honest, Steve, the idea of you hulking out does not immediately concern me, to be fair. So if it does drive you into a psychotic rage, I'll probably just shut the door and wait for you to calm down.
Yeah, I've got to say, ever since Mark said it, every time I watch Kingsman now when I'm testing a TV or something, all I can keep thinking is, this HDR, seriously, you will shit.
Yeah, they should really adopt that.
I heard a scurrilous rumour about the HDR on one facet
about
of the
HDR.
About the HDR implementation on Kingsman, that the very final scene actually had to be tweaked again with the Scandinavian princess, because HDR was revealing a little bit more than was actually intended to in the nature of the film. I'm not going to go any further, but essentially, additional contrast was revealing more than the print was, I think, supposed to do. So,
you imagine shadow detail could be an issue there, yeah. I tell you what, as soon as this podcast is over, that's the first thing I'm doing.
Mine's already loaded in.
He's just going to sit there with the Rock yelling at him over his mobile phone, slow-moing that scene. Oh.
And that's hardware news.
Okay, so moving on to movie news, because we ain't got any reviews. Film's opening this Friday, Steve.
I tell you what, we're not doing that again in a hurry. Getting to bed at 4 a.m. last week and then doing the podcast next morning.
And then The Rock telling you to get up at 6. Oh,
blimey, that was hard work. Movies opening on Friday. We've got Green Room, which is a thriller. And this is the plot, basically. After witnessing a murder, a punk band is forced into a vicious fight for survival against a group of maniacal skinheads. Green Room, obviously, is the room where if you know anything about backstage areas, that's usually where the band are hanging out. And I think from seeing the trailer, they're kind of locked in the green room trying to survive against all these skinheads. Stars Anton Yelchin, who plays Chekhov in Star Trek, and Imogen Poots, as well as Patrick Stewart, so make it so, number one. That's opening on Friday. We've also got Kill Command, which is a low-budget British film starring Vanessa Kirby. It's set in a near-future technology-reliant society that pits man against killing machines. Have not seen this, but Sharuna has already done the review because she saw it in a press screening about 2 months ago. I don't expect too much.
Well, if it was 2 months ago for the press screening, yeah, it's not going to be that great.
Nope. And also coming opening on Friday, and I can't believe they bothered with this because surely it's time's passed already, but it's the Angry Birds movie. So an animated film based on the popular mobile phone game with the voices of, and they can't possibly need the work, Sean Penn and Peter Dinklage. thanks for that, by the way, Ed. That's what I was thinking once you were in the opening credits on Monday night.
You're very welcome, and it will be like that forever now.
Anyway, I thought Angry Birds had long since, being just crushed by Candy Crush, I guess. So that's opening on Friday, animated film based on. I did watch the trailer out of curiosity, and it is basically the film quickly morphs into them essentially playing the game with Angry Birds and those pig things and that.
Sorry, Steve, who's been telling you all this? Because you don't know any of this. Candy Crush and Angry Birds.
I have played Angry Birds. Candy Crush, I got no idea what that is. I just know that it's down with the youth. But
It's cute.
I never played Candy Crush. I don't even know what it is. What is Candy Crush? I mean, I know it's a game, but what does the game entail?
It's a variation of Bubble Breaker where you're just breaking coloured sequences of candy.
God, that sounds boring.
I believe it's structured in such a way as to suck small amounts of money on a continuous basis away from idiots.
Yeah, all right. My favourite mobile phone game is Paper Toss, where you have to flick a rolled piece of paper into a dustbin. That's actually great fun.
My favourite phone game is Twitter.
it is a game, isn't it, basically?
Yeah,
it's a gigantic Twitter is, game.
Yeah. But the only additional I'll give to the Angry Birds, there was an interview with a chap in the Midwest a couple of days ago, and he was interviewed about the fact that a bird had he was flying a light aircraft and a bird had burst through the windscreen, and he was interviewed whilst he was wearing an Angry Birds t-shirt, which I thought was brilliant, but maybe just me.
Yeah, I think I was just you, Ed.
Oh, well, I am just in my own little world.
Basically not a great week to go to the cinema.
Yeah. Well, you know, this week we had obviously Star Wars Day, which is now a thing. You know, May the 4th be with you.
It'll never be Ed Ball's Day, though, will it?
Well, what they're now saying is that there's going to be two Star Wars Days in a row because they're going to call it Revenge of the 5th. Methinks they're getting a little bit carried away.
Damn Disney and their marketing machine.
Something very strange is going on. Sorry, I've just had a look at my Facebook. Two completely separate people within an hour of each other have wandered into rooms in their houses to find cats that they don't own. Is this some sort of Hitchcock thing going on here?
No, it's just that cats have a tendency to wander into people's houses and look for free food, don't they?
My cat used to disappear for days on end. I didn't worry because I knew he'd found somewhere to go and have food, which was the case, because when it came to moving and I couldn't move with him, the little old lady from along the road, who I never knew about, came along and said, I heard you're moving, can I have the cat? he's been coming to mine every day for chicken.
What a tart.
she was a little old deer. But
yeah, I'm in the cat.
Yeah, so if there was one, then obviously there's going to be a few more that he was going to, because he would disappear for days on end.
God, if Gizmo's gone for more than half an hour, Laura starts to panic. I keep saying, she's a cat, she'll be fine, she'll be back when she's hungry.
Our cats aren't allowed in the dark.
Gizmo's not allowed.
Jenny won't let him out. He's
no, Gizmo's only allowed out during the day. Mind you, we live in the sticks, so there are badgers and foxes and other things that might actually physically hurt Gizmo.
Badgers are an urban myth. Badgers don't actually exist, or if they do, they only exist.
I've only ever seen them as dead, rotting.
Yeah, as rotting things on the side of the road.
Oh, you too, man. A common sight up here, but then I do live.
I have seen a live badger.
Sorry?
I have seen a live badger, is what I mean.
I see them all the time.
But dead in the road does seem like their natural state.
Yeah. They just have a unique mating process.
To life at night.
I'm sure, Steve, if you went out for a walk around about your house and you looked really closely, you'd soon find the runs. You'd find the badger runs. They're quite easy to find, actually, if they're around.
I have seen a live badger once. It was in the back garden when I was a kid, and the dog was barking and barking and barking at the French window. So I opened it up, and the dog ran out, got towards the badger, realised it was a badger, then turned around and ran back in the house and was hiding under the bed. So badgers have got a well-armed reputation.
Well, they're pretty vicious. And
I wouldn't want to mess with one, no. One of them
took the valance off my Nova Sport. We're going back a few years ago now.
That's not. We're bearing a grudge.
Well, it ran out in front of me, and I managed to hit the brakes, but I hit it as well, and it went all, it rolled up the road, got up, and then buggered off up into the field. And I got out, checked the front of my car, and the front valance spoiler was gone. It ruined it.
Actually, when you think about how hard badgers are and also how big they are, when you do see one dead by the road, you must think, yeah, the car that hit it must have a massive dent in the front.
Oh, yeah, leave a lot of damage. A lot of damage. Hell, I hit a pheasant not that long ago and completely cracked the front fog lamps in my last car. And I didn't hit it very hard.
Yeah, the worst ones around where I live, a deer. Deer keep jumping out in front of you.
Yeah, well, Steve, if you hit a deer, you're probably going to die.
Depends how fast you're going, doesn't it?
Yeah, but if it comes through the windscreen, you've had it.
I do remember a friend of mine. He had a Mitsubishi Lancer Evolution, and he ran over a squirrel, which then splattered up all over the intercooler, and the smell.
Oh hell!
The smell was just horrendous, of entrails cooking against a hot intercooler.
Oh, lovely!
Just most unpleasant. Even Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall would not have eaten that.
Yeah. Sorry, what were we talking about?
Yeah, and the best one was I was on a way a job with a colleague, and the colleague was driving at the time in my old job, so the blue lights were flashing, and this owl swooped down and took off the blue light off the top of the car, completely removed the whole thing. And of course, we ended up going to the emergency job, and by the time we got back and then told the sergeant what had happened, he's like, "F off, that never happened. An owl hit the lights. Who do you think? Well, you think I was born yesterday?" So we had to go all the way, trace our steps all the way back and find this carcass of the owl and take it to prove that he'd taken the blue lights off.
I'm disappointed that it was actually just, it killed itself. I just have visions of it actually taking it off like prey.
No.
Flying away with a gantry beneath it.
No, it took the whole thing. We were doing some speed, by the way. We hit it at some rate of knots, and it took it clean off.
It's a nice dead animal special.
Roadkill special.
It's going to be a lovely picture to accompany this podcast on the front page. Oh,
yeah. Right, so that's the film's opening this Friday.
Badger's Ask, by the way, is not opening this Friday.
Right, okay, quickly moving on. Blu-ray's released this week.
Yeah, this week we've got The Hateful Eight, which is the eighth film from Quentin Tarantino, shot in Super 35 Panavision. So that's a 2.76:1 aspect ratio. I've actually seen the film already, and it is absolutely stunning. Looks gorgeous. Not such a great film. It goes on for 3 hours, and it's a bit self-indulgent, to say the least. But it certainly does
never
look
a
business.
Quentin Tarantino film self-indulgent.
This is really self-indulgent. It's a very light plot hung on about 3 hours of people talking. Yeah, it would have been a good 2-hour movie, but it's a struggle at 3. But it does look amazing. The cinematography is absolutely stunning in it. And it is quite unusual to see a film with that aspect ratio. So for that reason alone, worth checking out. And also coming out this week, we got on Monday is Room, which is a young boy is raised within the confines of a small shed. So basically it's about Fritzl and his victims. Whilst that might not sound like a very pleasant experience, apparently it's a very uplifting and moving film. And Brie Larson, who stars in it as the mother of the little boy, she won an Oscar for Best Actress this year for this film. So apparently, I haven't seen it myself, but apparently it is very good, and she is extremely good in it.
I like they stipulated small shed.
Yeah.
What, a medium-sized shed?
Bloody
what's he complaining about?
a palatial shed.
In my day.
A number of people have said that's quite a good film. I'll put it on the list of things I may watch in the next decade.
I think in my case, it'll be something I've ended up watching, you know, on TV or on a streaming service or something.
If it comes out on UHD Blu-ray, you know you'll be watching it in the next month.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, actually.
Okay, so we discussed Tarantino there. He's done quite a few films now, actually. But has he gotten any better with age, I think, is the main question. What would our picks of his films be? And I'm going to go first, because I never go first on these things. If I was to pick my favourite Tarantino stuff, there's nothing recent for me. No. For me, it'd have to be True Romance, which I know technically he didn't direct, but it's still regarded as a Tarantino film. 2 would be Pulp Fiction, which I think is an absolute masterpiece of cinema. It's so quotable, it's so memorable, and even the structure, the way the film's put together, fantastic. Next, From Dusk Till Dawn, which he did screenplay for, and again he starred in it as well. And for me, that's just it's two films in one, basically. And yeah, And I think I was so disappointed the first time I saw it because it went all silly. But then actually, it's just played for laughs the second half, and it's just absolutely brilliant. I absolutely love that film. Love it to death. And finally, I think I'd go Reservoir Dogs, and that's basically because that was his breakout movie. And it's a small movie, it's small budget and all the rest of it, but dialogue-wise, much like Pulp Fiction, very quotable and very memorable. And there's one specific memorable scene in there as well. So that would be mine with, I think, a mention for Jackie Brown, possibly Samuel L. Jackson's best line ever. In any film whatsoever, the AK-47 line. I'm not going to say it here because I'd have to use the bleep machine quite a bit. And really, the only other one I can think of, and again, it's an old film, is Natural Born Killers, which he was obviously responsible for the story and that. That I think is his, for me anyways, his highlights. And going back, that's like more than 10 years ago, it's 15 years ago since his last bit of good work, in my opinion.
I don't know. I did quite enjoy Django Unchained. It's not my favourite. I mean, I would say for two different... I mean, in terms of it being a Tarantino film, I like Jackie Brown. It's self-indulgent and it's a little bit long, but I really, really like it. It's a cracking film to watch. I am also going to stick a candle up for Death Proof, which I really like. But that's as much because of all of the nods to various crappy 70s road movies, which I also
That's still 10 years ago, Death Proof.
Well, you know, I'm not saying it's a little bit more. It's 9 years ago, in fairness. But yeah, it's okay. It's not in its first flush of youth, but I really like that film. Really like it.
He's only done two films since then, so he's not exactly... No, three films, sorry. Not exactly prolific anyway.
But no, I think I Death Proof is a right guilty pleasure film. Bizarrely, it's my wife's favourite Tarantino film. Don't ask me why, but yeah, it's the one that we find the easiest to agree on and watch.
I think the ones that get forgotten about are the Kill Bill films.
I'd really love to see Kill Bill, the whole bloody story, the 4-hour cut where it's combined into a single, as originally intended, a single film before it was cut into two movies by the Weinsteins to squeeze a bit more cash out of it, basically. But I'd be quite keen to see the full uncut, full 4-hour version. I've got the Japanese DVD actually of Kill Bill Volume 1 because that's got the House of the Blue Leaf sequence completely in colour with all the violence intact, whereas in the UK and US releases that sequence is in black and white. But I do find that to be quite a fun movie. But the way it's currently structured is very much two different films. It's a kung fu movie and a western, effectively. Part 2 is more like a western. I think it would work better as originally written and intended to be a single movie, but I do enjoy it. Although it is the beginning of when he started to get quite self-indulgent, which is reaching its apex, I think, with The Hateful Eight.
Another one, I think, in Inglourious Basterds starts out so promising. The beginning of that film, when they're hiding under the floorboards and the whole conversation, I mean, talk about tension.
Mm.
And then it just goes, it's complete and utter fantasy after that.
It does have some cracking moments in it, though. It really does.
Yeah.
I hated it when I saw it at the cinema, but actually I really like it now. It grew on me. I think because when I went to the cinema, I was expecting it to be kind of his version of the Dirty Dozen, and it really isn't that at all. And then so initially I was like, oh, it's a bit boring. But now I love it. I think it's great. I do enjoy Django Unchained, but like you, Phil, without a doubt, my favourite Quentin Tarantino movie is True Romance. I love True Romance.
Yeah, I'm very much a fan of his earlier stuff as well, so I'm going to say all the same ones you've already said. I've got nothing new to add, but it's Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown. Sin City I quite enjoyed, but that's probably more to do with Jessica Alba than anything else. Natural Born Killers, I enjoyed that. True Romance was fantastic. I like his taste in music. We're not really touched on that. Some of the soundtracks are just fantastic for me. They kind of make the movies as well.
I don't know if this is true, but I've read somewhere that the music in his films is actually his music. So in other words, you know, it's his record that they're using, or from his collection, in order for the soundtrack. So,
I never knew that. I just definitely share quite a lot of his music.
So it's not just he's selecting songs; he's actually using his music. You know, his own collection of records and whatever CDs and things.
Some of the scenes are actually written to the music as well.
Yeah.
So he finds the track before he gets the mood, before he gets the whole thing coming together, which I find interesting because sometimes when I edit videos and that kind of thing, I'll find the music track first. Once I know that, then I know what my pace is and all this. So it's interesting that he uses that technique to find the song first, and then he writes his scene and puts the scene together because the music's And I guess, Ed, that's something that you would relate to as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah, he really resurrected the idea of avoiding using a score and just sort of, you know, getting stuff together. I mean, don't get me wrong, a number of 80s blockbusters used that success very, very successfully, but in part because they had used it very, very successfully, you then saw a sort of backlash and a move back to sort of dedicated scores and the rest of it. And then he sort of made it, if you like, a slight A, sort of more artistically credible, and B, actually then came out with some cracking scores as a result of that. I would agree with you that there are occasions where, in many ways, I have to say, this is a heresy moment. I don't get that excited about Pulp Fiction, but I do love the Pulp Fiction soundtrack. So, yeah. Jackie Brown soundtrack, great film, and the soundtrack is arguably even better still.
Yeah.
Agreed. Love the soundtrack to that film.
I think what a lot of people forget about Pulp Fiction as well is that it saved a few careers. And yeah, actually relaunched a few careers again. So, you know, Travolta, Bruce Willis was waning at that moment in time as well. So, you know, there was a number in there who really benefited from that. And Samuel L. Jackson, I think the film made him. You know, I think before that he was a relative unknown.
Yeah, you're right, Phil. He's definitely resurrected quite a few careers. And he has an eye for finding actors maybe you haven't seen on screen for some time and bringing them back in. He does get together some very impressive cast lists on his movies. If you look at Django Unchained, that Leonardo DiCaprio is fantastic playing the villain in that, which is unusual for him. He doesn't normally play villainous roles, and he's really, really good in it. As for Christoph Waltz, I mean, his entire career has basically been created by Tarantino. He's won two Oscars for two Tarantino films.
I'm afraid I don't really get on with modern Tarantino films at all. I don't like using the term vanity project, but I just find, even if I can get past some of the uses of violence, even if I can get past the kind of imprecise tone management of it all, that it's kind of throwing all of his ideas at the wall and just seeing what sticks, I just find that the pacing in particular, I really struggle with. And if you go back to something like Jackie Brown, it's not just a case of, you know, his films have gotten longer. Jackie Brown was, you know, I think that was approaching the 3-hour point, probably like 2:40, something like that. But it was well paced. Now, whether that's because it came from good source material or not, you can make that argument. But I just find myself kind of increasingly moving away, because I feel like I'm watching, you know, I get that they're the films that he wants to make. But when I go back and say watch something like Reservoir Dogs or Jackie Brown, I feel like I'm watching a tighter film. It's like reading a book by someone who you think they just need a strong editor to say, you know, take this 400 page book and turn it into a 300 page, you know, absolute belter, a page turner.
I think there's very few directors though that remain tight as they get more popular. The only one I can think of is Spielberg, who actually remains, but even then, I mean, his last few films have been a bit vanity project style, haven't they? I mean,
a bit boring.
Yeah, just a bit.
But don't you find that it's often almost like I understand that with a couple of ideas, you like a kind of an itch they need to scratch, but it just seems like that's now what modern Tarantino is. It's going to be kind of his ideas on his terms. Maybe it's always been that way, but when I go back to whichever ones were my favourites, I kind of end up more with Reservoir Dogs, just that kind of rough, raw feel of something that was kind of hits you and it leaves you wanting more. Whereas with Django Unchained, I'm afraid it's one of those instances where it left me wanting less. Like the final reel was just largely pointless. And as the moment that he turned up, it was that kind of jump in the shark moment of, this is just getting ridiculous now. You know, there are moments in there where I feel almost like the asides, the little kind of comic asides with characters talking about kind of inconsequential things, has become so much of a Tarantino staple, so much of something that now people expect. That, like when they have the conversation in Django Unchained about the masks that they're going to wear and riding down, it's played for comic effect to the point that it's almost so willing you to laugh that you find yourself saying, well, it's not actually that funny. You know,
actually, I thought that scene was really funny.
Oh, what? I just find it so kind of forced now. I would really love to see him tackle something, you know, like with Rum Punch, like with, you know, take another Elmore Leonard story, because he did that so well. He seems to understand that style that Leonard has, that, you know, pattern of speech, and he can bring that to screen really well. I feel now like almost he's trying to just work through all of the ideas that he had, and some of them perhaps just will come out seeming lopsided.
Do you honestly think if another actor said to him, I'm going to play this part with an Australian accent, like he did himself in Django Unchained, he'd have gone, yeah, okay. That just seemed unnecessary and self-indulgent, and he's guilty of it a lot recently. And I guess you're right, absolutely right, Mark. The problem is that point when a director becomes powerful enough, there's no one there to tell him, that's a really stupid idea, yep, or cut that scene out because it's, yep, too long, or that scene's not necessary.
Yeah, as soon as you get any sort of power in career and any kind of say, you find that most directors, like I say, I can only think of Spielberg, who up until recently tended to keep things really tight and have good editors and good people around him and actually listen to people around him. So anyway, just to wrap it up on the movie side, the only thing we haven't spoken about so far in the movie area, Steve, is Ultra HD Blu-ray. Any more updates with the format, or have we seen most of the announcements so far?
We've one more announcement came out this week, and interestingly, it's the first double dip of the format, so that's good going. We're only a couple of months into the format, and there already is a double dip. We're going to get the extended cut of The Martian arriving on Ultra HD Blu-ray on the 7th of June. This is in the US. I don't know about the UK, but certainly in the US, we're getting our first double dip, so nice one there. Also, a little bit of stats for you guys. I thought it was quite interesting. Total US consumer home entertainment spending in quarter one of 2016 was $4.6 billion, which is about the same as the previous quarter in the previous year. There were more than 80,000 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray discs sold in the first week of the format's availability, which is double what the first week of Blu-ray was. There are 1.5 million 4K TV sold in the States in the first quarter of this year, which is up 210% from the previous year. And so the total number of 4K TV sets in the States at the moment is 7 million. So not looking too bad for this format there, actually. I've got to say that's quite positive news for a new format.
It's not the biggest news story of the week, though. Biggest news story of the week was Leicester City winning the Premier League. Congratulations, Leicester City. That was phenomenal.
Yes, yeah, that was a surprise.
I'm not even sure this is reality.
Yeah, it is a bit strange. I mean, when it got to Christmas and they were still there, you tended to start thinking, well, this maybe could happen. But then you just had that in your head saying, no, because I've still got to play Arsenal, I've still got to play Tottenham at that point, and they still had to play Man U, and you're thinking, no, they can't do it. It won't happen. The fact that they have done it, well done, that is just absolutely brilliant.
It won't happen again. That's it for another 40 years.
Well, the last club to kind of have that kind of success would have been...
Nottingham Forest, really.
1977, wasn't it?
So maybe Leicester will go on to win the European Cup for the next 2 years.
Yeah, one step at a time.
Probably not.
But no, an impressive achievement nonetheless. Whilst I don't necessarily disagree with Mr. Ranieri's statement that it will be back to money talking for the next couple of years, it hopefully has shown some lessons about what constitutes player value and so on and so forth, and that perhaps more care and attention needs to be paid to the process. So yeah, we'll see how it goes from there.
It gives great hope to no-hopers and, you know, those rejects out there. You know, you just clump together like we have on the podcast here, and one day you might be successful.
Top of iTunes this time next season.
No question, Mark.
Well, honestly, when you said the most exciting news this week, I thought you were going to go on to Nintendo's financial report. So that was just me.
Oh, yeah, we forgot to ask you. What did you think of the news last week that you weren't here to tell us about?
What, that Zelda's been delayed again and that the NX is coming out March next year?
Yeah.
As ever, I won't be shocked if there are further delays further down the line. And it's a pretty ballsy move not to really be showing much at E3. But it will be slightly strange. It's a slightly strange idea that you'll be showing only one game as a playable. Only one game will be playable, and that will be on a format that you're actually trying to kill off, and you're not going to show the version that's on the new format that you want people to buy. So it's a weird way of hyping something, but could just work.
Is it a bombshell, Mark?
Yes, it is a massive bombshell.
Okay.
To me, at least.
So that's it for the podcast this week. We found a bombshell to end on. My thanks to Steve Withers.
He is a rambunctious sort, ain't he?
Mark Hodgkinson.
Auf Wiedersehen, bullseye.
Ed Selly.
Your boss looks a little green around the gills.
And Mark Borry.
Get off my land.
Dove.
You can't do that in a West Country accent. Get off my land.
Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, bookmark AV Forums, the latest reviews, news and video, and of course leave us those 5-star ratings on iTunes. We'll read them out, so do it. Leave us 5 stars, can't be anything less. I'm Phil Hinton, thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you again next Monday.